Welcome back to another episode of Better Than I Found It, the podcast All Things College Golf. You're listening to Mike McGraw, the men's golf coach at Baylor University. Today's guest is one of the best-known PGA Tour caddies, Paul Tesori. Paul, who has worked with such great players as Vijay Singh, Jerry Kelly, Sean O'Hare, and for over 10 years, Webb Simpson, is one of the great caddies in the game. He has over 25 wins on the PGA Tour and just recently took on the bag of Cameron Young, one of the bright young stars in all of golf today. Paul's faith is shared during this podcast, along with some incredible caddy wisdom. There's also a pretty good Tiger Woods story in there too. I think you'll think this is a great listen. Okay, Better Than I Found It listeners, let's welcome longtime PGA Tour caddy Paul Tesori to Better Than I Found It today. Paul, it's a real pleasure to have you on today.
Yeah, Coach, what a pleasure to be on. You know, anytime I can have a chance to speak to a legend like you, I'm going to take the opportunity and have a little fun with it.
Well, I appreciate that. You're a legend too now, and you can be legends for lots of different reasons. Some of mine is in the vault, and the statute of limitations has me safe on that. I know you're probably very much the same on that as well.
Absolutely. There are there's been a few different little segments to my life/career. So, yes, there's a lot of stuff in the vault as well. Unfortunately for me, almost everyone that's still in my life, they know it all. So they remind me every now and then if my head gets a little too big.
We're not going to bring a whole lot of that out. Let's start with this. Most people, definitely most of my listeners, and we don't have a large group, but we have a very loyal group of listeners. Most of them know you as a professional caddy, quite frankly, for some really big names. What people really don't know is you were really a good player when you were younger, actually, in your own right. You played college golf for Buddy Alexander at Florida. You even played on the tour for a time. So I want to hear about, before we start about the caddy, I want to hear about Paul Tesori, the golfer.
Yeah. You know, I was born and raised here in North Florida. I'm in Ponte Vedra now, but just down the road at St. Augustine. My grandfather was a starter at Ponte Vedra Inning Club. First time, you know, I ever walked on a golf course was the 1977 Players Championship, which was across the street.
Mark Hayes won.
So a great story about Mark Hayes. Can't believe you know that, but he was my favorite golfer for a long time because, you know, people would say Nicklaus and Watson. Well, the first time I had ever gone to a professional event, Mark Hayes won. So I thought he was the greatest player in the world. And obviously he was my favorite golfer. So Mark Hayes's name will never leave far, you know, from my rooting films. That's for sure. But that's kind of where my little background came from. You know, we didn't have a whole lot of money, couldn't play a lot of the national events, but was a good player growing up. Went to a junior college for a couple of years, had a lot of success there. Our team won a national championship, and I played well, a two-time first-team All-American there. And then here came Florida, and we were fortunate Florida win a national championship in 93 and then in 94 as well. And, you know, one of my favorite stories, and at the time I didn't love it so much, but it kind of leads into your question about kind of what led me from player into the next part of my career. But Buddy Alexander always said, he goes, "Paulie, if there was a foxhole of anybody I'd want in it, it would be you." It was a compliment. I knew what he meant. Really, my talent level, we were on the same team with Brian Gay and Chris Couch, who both won on the PGA Tour, and Brian's gone on to have a long career. But what he meant is, I might not have the talent as a lot as the other guys, but I'm going to fight with everything I had down to the very end. And, you know, it kind of stayed with me. I got through Q school my very first try through. I got on tour. My goal wasn't to play on the PGA Tour at first. I wanted to get my status on the Nike Tour back then, which is now the Korn Ferry Tour. I just knew I wasn't quite ready yet. And when I got my card, I immediately thought, well, it's time to do what everybody else does. So I went out with Duval and Furyk and Vijay and practiced every day, and eventually tore my rotator cuff and labrum in my left shoulder. And again, that kind of foxhole guy came through, and I just tried to play through it. And eventually my body gave out, and then once my body got healthy, the brain never came back. So my career was very short-lived. And fast forward to 2000, and that's kind of where the Paul Tesori golfer is going to leave behind, and it transfers into my next part of my career.
So how did you go from being a player? I mean, what was your first opportunity as a caddy? I mean, was it with somebody famous, or was it just a mini tour player?
Yeah, this is one of those reasons why I might not have been very well liked my first little stretch on tour. So my first opportunity was with Vijay Singh, who at the time would have been a two-time major winner, a top 20 player in the world. So Vijay and I had practiced and played a lot together. We had grown to be good friends, had a lot of dinners together, a lot of lunches together, a lot of hard conversations together. I would even help him with his golf swing quite often at that time. So late in 2000, I was teaching full time at this point. And it was in August of 2000, and Vijay called and goes, "Hey, I don't know if this is disrespectful or not. I just want to ask you anyway, but would you like to come out and caddy for me?" Oh, did I just lose you guys?
No, you're here. You're here.
Okay. All right. And I'm sorry, I lost you guys just for a second, but he asked if I would like to come out for a little bit. And, obviously my answer was, of course I would. At the time, I wasn't making very much money. And the opportunity to go work for VJ for a week, or even more than that, obviously was too good to pass up. So I said yes. And that was in August of 2000. My first event was in Flint, Michigan at the old Buick Classic. And we played well that week. I found something in his golf swing that he liked. So the next week, he hired me as his swing coach. And it just happened to be Jack's last PGA championship at Valhalla and just happened to be paired with Tiger
Tiger Woods.
Woods and VJ. So my first kind of introduction to world-class golf was still to this day the biggest crowds I've ever seen in my life, the most buzz I've ever seen in my life. You're looking at Tiger, who was going for three in a row at the time. Vijay, who had won the other major that year, being the Masters, and then Jack playing in his last PGA. And I still have such fond memories. Vijay missed the cut, which obviously stunk for him. Tiger was playing well, but Jack had to hole a wedge on the last hole to make the cut, and he almost did. Made birdie, missed the cut by one. But I still kind of remember that this day. I was like, man, this is something I'd like to be a part of. And I knew my playing career was pretty much done at that time. And just so happened at the end of that week, Vijay asked me to come work for him full time. And so, voila, there we go. And that kind of has run off the next 23 years.
You know, how does anybody that now I'm not saying this in a negative way, but it just fell right in your lap right there because of a relationship you had with VJ, which was great. But wow, what a start to cut caddying.
It really was. I asked Vij much later on, I'm talking about years after our relationship ended, why he asked me. And it was kind of neat, his answer. He goes, "Paul," he goes, "I've never seen anyone so curious and such a hard worker. And if there's two things in this game," this was him talking, "there's two things I think that can get you to where we wanted to go," which when VJ and I first sat down and we developed an entire process and a plan to overtake, in my opinion, the greatest player that ever lived, being Tiger, how are we going to do this? And he said that the first thing that came up to his mind was a guy who had played, so a high golf IQ. Someone who was a hard worker, which I had, and me, I was just curious. I didn't want to leave any stone unturned. And so that was his answer when I'd asked him later. But that's just the hard work aspect, which I was taught by my grandfather and my dad. No matter what you're doing, remember my first job at a cart barn with 14 years old at the Ponce de Leon, a old Donald Ross golf course down here. Just said, "Hey, if you're sweep," I complained, I think after my second day, they just had me sweeping floors. And my dad was quick to give me a little lesson right there. He goes, "Son, it's a blessing to have a job. Why don't you just go do the best job anyone's ever done at sweeping those floors, and you'll see what'll happen." And it stuck with me to this day.
Great. I got the same lesson from my dad. It's amazing the men from that generation, how, and my dad passed away in 2010, but his generation, how hard work was part and parcel of who you were as a human. You didn't even question it.
Absolutely.
And I learned that same thing. But speaking of hard workers, Vijay has long been considered like one of the hardest workers in any sport as a professional. The man literally work. Now, those are stories I'm hearing, and I saw him at tournaments and whatever. Is any of that hyperbole? Like sometimes Ben Hogan practiced until his hands bled every day, which he really didn't, but maybe his hands bled a few times. Is it hyperbole, or was VJ that hard a worker?
Yeah, I've never seen anybody so driven to succeed. And first of all, it was his hobby. It was his addiction. It was his profession. And also happened to be what he was elite at. So all of it kind of fell into one thing. I remember his wife, Adina, saying they celebrated four holidays every year. And you could guess what four of those were. That would be the Masters, the US Open, the British Open, and the PGA. Those were kind of their four holidays. So Yes, he was the hardest worker I ever saw. Starting in 2001, I've been working for him for a few months. Again, we were starting to put together this plan to eventually try to overtake Tigers being number one in the world. And I think VJ was 13 or 14th at the time and do all this. Well, one of the things on the plan was body. Tiger's body was stronger. He was more flexible. He was able to do things. So we set out, and Joey DeOvisalvi came into the mix in January of 2001. And for the next 5 years of my relationship there, he did two-a-day workouts every day, never missed a day, 365 days a year. He worked out once in the morning and once at night, and that never changed. In 2001, I had a total of 11 days off out of 365. In 2002, I had 12 days off out of 365. VJ took one day off total out of those 730 days. Is that right? 365 times two. All right. Florida yep. education came through for me there.
Got it.
But yeah, he took one day off, and it was, I think it was a holiday, and it rained all day. He said he never touched a club. I still doubt that was true. He used to have this old 10 pound kind of really, really heavy steel shaft with a big rectangle block on the end. It weighed 10 pounds. And you know, even Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday on tour, he would bring that around the golf course. At that time, he used to have a really shut face, and that's why we thought we were losing tournaments under the gun. He'd get nervous. He would hit it left. And we thought, man, if we could just, you know, get rid of that, you know, shut face and learn to get a little cup in that wrist. And so every day he would swing it hundreds of times a day. So when people talk about his work ethic, the worst time of my career at the time is when daylight savings would come back around. So when we would get more daylight, because he didn't really like waking up early. So, you know, he would wake up about 7:30 every day, have coffee, go work out. But unfortunately, when there was more daylight at the end of the day, there was more work to be done. And, you know, I mean, man, I look back now, and obviously he's the reason why I became what I've kind of become in my job. He's the reason why I've become one of the better caddies in the world. It's just because of all the kind of tools he taught me, but also that plan that him and I put together. It worked for us. And then I moved on to Jerry Kelly. It worked for him and I. And I moved on to Sean O'Hare, a young 25-year-old. It worked for us. And then another 25-year-old later on, Webb Simpson. You know, now I'm on my third straight 25-year-old. I keep getting older. But the age of the players I'm going to work for seems to stay the same. But
well, I
know I'm jumping ahead. But
I feel the same way. I keep getting older. These college players are all 18 to 22 every time. They never change. but so I'm glad to hear that that's not exaggeration with VJ. And I think you won nine times in 2004 and got to number one in the world. So your plan sort of worked there to kind of take Tiger and push him aside for a moment. But that's amazing. I'm glad to hear that story. Best Tiger Woods story. Boom. Best one you've got that we can say on a podcast.
It is absolutely. So the story most people want to hear is the embarrassment of the fact that I wore a Tiger Who hat in 2000 at the President's Cup. I'm going to try to make a very long story a medium story. Kind of okay. Hard to go short. But my third event caddying as a full-time caddy for VJ, President's Cup. We get paired four of the five matches against Tiger. Of course, here comes singles. That was the same year Tiger won three majors. VJ won the other one. So the international team was getting smoked. The U.S. team, I think, only needed 2 points to win. We get paired against Tiger. We show up at the course on Sunday. And the ball guys had made up 12 hats for the international team, stitched beautifully, just said Tiger Who on the back. I thought it was funny. All the other caddies, we all said we were going to wear it. We thought it was a joke. I showed it to VJ. He laughed. Let's wear it. So we get on the golf course, and one, two, and three are normal. We're one up through three, and we get to number four, and Tiger hits a poor tee shot in the water on the par three out there in Virginia, I think Robert Trent Jones golf course. And VJ hit a great iron about 11 feet. Tiger hit a chip to 20 feet for bogey. So VJ did what you're supposed to do. Hey, that's good, Tiger. Pick it up. Knowing that Tiger's just going to say, hey, VJ, that 11-footer for birdie's good. I know you can two-putt. Nothing. Weird. Okay. So VJ hits this 11-footer. It's going to go in. It's hanging on the lip. One of those you would count to 10 before you see. And we don't really hear anything. You assume he's already said good. But you turn around, and he's sitting on the side of the green, and he's got this scowl on his face. And VJ says, Paulie, I don't think he thinks your hat is as funny as you and I do. So we tap it in, again, from hanging over the lip. It's looking down the hole. And I'll never forget, because Tiger had played pretty poorly all week. His partner, who a lot of people forget, was Nota Begay, who at the time was one of the best players in the world. He had won four times, I believe, in a 15-month stretch at the time. was a top 10 player and one of Tiger's best friends, still is one of Tiger's best friends. And Tiger just had played poorly. You could tell he wasn't into it. The U.S. was dominating the competition. Well, the fifth hole is a par five, and all I remember is that big old turn of his got about 15 degrees more, and he hit about a 300-yard mid-height draw right down the middle of the fairway. Nowadays, that would be a 335-yard draw, that same swing. And he was 7-under over the next 13 to beat us 2-1. And so, you know, we got done, get attacked by media. I had no idea what I was doing. I didn't really know what this was going to do. It wasn't my intention, but it was definitely shown as a sign of disrespect. So we get paired together the next 5 weeks in a row. Of course we do. They're not speaking at all. And finally, I've had enough. Same personality I have now. I'm like, I just went up to Tiger and said, hey, buddy, this is awkward. You and VJ aren't talking. I don't know what you thought about the hat. Let me explain real quick. It was meant to be a joke. Funny. Obviously, you're the best player in the world, one of the best of all time already. I didn't mean disrespect. He smiled and he shook my hand. He said, thanks for saying that. He goes, I wasn't angry, but it didn't make me want to kick y'all's, you know what. So, you know, that was kind of – so the last part of my story, we didn't talk about it again for about 11 years. It had been 2011. And we're sitting on a putting green, and Tiger loves to play Call of Duty. And he can never think of a name. He thinks people are going to know who he is. I'm like, buddy, that's dumb. Nobody's going to know who you are. Just have a different handle. You should be Tiger Who. And he laughed about it or whatever. And so he's walking by the putting green, working for Weber. I said, Weber, watch this. I'm going to get him. And he's walking right by. I said, what's up, Tiger Who? He said, what's up, 2-1? And he just kept walking. It had been 11 years. We haven't spoken it at all. There wasn't a single ounce. And I think what we've learned about Tiger nowadays is I think every time he saw me, probably even to this day, he thought 2-1, and he ended up getting me back. He was the captain of the President's Cup over in 2019 in Australia. And for picture day, he had all the caddies wear Paul Who on the back of their hat, and he wore Paul Who 2-1 on the front of his hat. So he got me back about 19 years later, but that's one of my favorite Tiger stories.
Well, I've never heard that story. I remember the situation, Tiger. I remember it happening, but to hear the whole story is pretty amazing. And obviously, he's kind of taken it. It's not so serious now for him.
Yes.
Obviously, which is
yes.
Great.
Yes.
Okay. So your longest stint pretty much with anybody would be Webb Simpson. So you're on his bag for all seven of his PGA Tour victories, U.S. Open, a Players Championship, three Ryder Cups, three Presidents. I mean, this is a great, great stretch that you had with Webb. And it's been documented fairly recently when you guys parted ways back in, I think it was March, so pretty recently. He said, I could never have done this without Paul by my side. Not only has he been my caddy and swing coach, but one of the best friends in the world. And he just goes on to just praise you. This is the most amiable, amicable breakup in the history of player caddy in history. And obviously, it's mainly because he's stepping back from the game a little bit. But talk about your relationship. What made you guys so successful?
Yeah, I mean, I get emotional just hearing, you know, still hearing about it. You know, what a dear friend and what a great human being. So I went to go work for Weber in 2011. Me and Sean O'Hare had a really good run together, President's Cup team. And only time I was fired in my life was that Sean, we had struggled a little bit in 2010. We didn't make the last event that year. We were still top 30 in the world, but he thought he wanted to try something a little bit different. And, you know, I was kind of like up in the air at the time. A lot of people know faith is important to me, and I had just become a believer in 2010. So I had a goal, and that was I wanted my next job to last more than 3 years. That was kind of the run of the mill for all my other relationships. And if I could choose, I wanted it to be a believer. And I had two incredible offers at the end of that year from two guys that were top 20 in the world. One was top 10 in the world. I just didn't want to say yes, but I knew it was getting that time. And I was about an hour from accepting one of those two jobs when the phone rang, and it was Webb Simpson. And I didn't know much about Webb. I knew he was a believer, and I knew he was a great guy. So real quick, my now wife got on the computer, and she's looking up and saw that he was 213th in the world and just kept his card in the last tournament of the year before. And that was pretty scary. At the time, you know, we had the big real estate crash and financial crash of 08, 09, and 10. I didn't have any money. And it was nerve-wracking. But I said, you know what? I'm going to take a chance. This is what I said I've been looking for, a believer. I asked Webb a lot of questions. He later on said that I interviewed him instead of him interviewing me for that phone call. But I just wanted to make sure that he was hungry, that he wanted to achieve great things, and he did. It was evident. So I went to go work for him, and you know, that year I had written down some goals. I had written down 7 top 10s, 14 top 25s, $2 million, which would have been more than his career earnings at the time. I thought these were really aggressive thoughts, and it just shows sometimes how my scouting wasn't very good. In that year, he made $9.3 million. He won twice, had 12 top 10s, I think 22 top 25s, finished second in the Vardon Trophy, second in the Player of the Year voting, second in the FedEx Cup, and just a monster year. And one of the things I realized very, very quick was that, you know, Webb is unlike any other person, to be honest with you, I've ever met. They broke the mold when they made him. He is really, really honest. He's really hardworking. He's a devoted husband and now dad. He didn't have any kids at that time, but now has 5. He's devoted to his profession. When he's at the golf course, he's at the course to work. When he's home, he's at home to serve. And so, you know, with Webb, very, very quickly, he was relying on me for a lot of golf stuff, but I was relying on him for a lot of life stuff, to be honest with you. Even though he was younger, he was very, very wise beyond his years when I went to go work for him. So,
well, he was further down his faith journey than you obviously were.
Yeah. Much, much. Yeah, I was brand new to faith, even though I was quite a bit older than Weber at the time. But yes, him and his wife, Dowd, were already walking very, very closely with the Lord. And their faith, obviously for them, was the number one thing they put above everything else. And so it started there for them. And I've always said, if you want to know how to gain wisdom, you can just follow what those two did. And obviously for me, faith being so important, the Bible is evident that, you know, if you're obedient to the word, then you're going to have this wisdom. And that's what Webb and Dowd did. And he lived his life that way the entire time. And, you know, we had a lot of downs. We have the ups that you mentioned, the wins and the tournament teams and all that kind of stuff. But so many downs that people don't see, a lot of tears, some anger moments as well that came out. And, you know, when they had the putting ban and he developed the yips with the short putter, trying to battle through that. I mean, there were some times there that, man, I didn't think that we could survive through, but it all ended up making it into how much more special kind of coming out of that was. Winning the Players in 18 was still, for me, I've been fortunate to win 25 times on tour and a major and a tour championship and all this. But for me, the Players was my greatest achievement as a caddy. And for us to do that after overcoming the yips, getting past the short putter ban, and then eventually in 2020, you know, having a chance to be number one in the world, we teed it up 4 times in a row with a chance to be one. So, I know there's a lot of information in there, and I could talk about mine and Weber's thing, but again, it was very similar to rewind back to what VJ and I did. We put together a plan in place and had a lot to do with his coach growing up. Ted Kegel helped us put together this plan. And, you know, eventually we brought Butch Harmon on, who we would work with a couple times a year. And he helped us with that plan, just putting it together. How do we get better? He worked on his body. He worked on his mechanics. He worked on the things he needed to work on. And then, you know, has had already a pretty good career, and I don't think he's done yet. I definitely think he has another couple of wins in him.
I love hearing that story, and I love the faith part of it, obviously. But it's incredible that you would have such success. I mean, he wasn't a star when you got to him. He's ranked outside the top 200. So some of the things, obviously, that you agreed on and you guys could work together with obviously helped him develop as a player. But I'm going to ask you a question. A good friend of ours, who I won't mention, well, it may or may not be Brad Payne of College Golf Fellowship.
I'm nervous already.
Of the PGA Tour Bible Study. It may or may not be Brad, but we're going to remain anonymous here.
I like that.
This person wanted me to ask you, how much further does Cameron Young, who you're working with now, hit it than Webb? And he said it's almost like he went from carrying 7 woods to 7 wedges in the bag. How much further?
Well, Mike, my goodness. Yes, Cameron is – wow. So I'd played a lot of practice rounds with him. When he first came out of college, he kind of relied on Webb and I. We played, I don't know, 20-so practice rounds together. He just kind of wanted to lean on us, and he asked a lot of great questions, which just shows some wisdom on his part to try to find, you know, 2 veterans to come out and learn from. And I guess when you're out there working on your own game, trying to really learn golf course, you're not really paying attention to how much farther he's hitting the golf ball. But I'm now 4 tournaments in with Cam, and yes, it's unlike anything else. I made actually a couple of mistakes at Quail Hollow just because I remember the second morning, Friday morning, it's 54 degrees out. The ball's not going very far. And on number 11, which was our second hole, there's a a run out at 325, and you could hit it another 20 yards past that and be perfectly fine to a left pin. And so I gave him that as our target. Mm. And he hit it right at the target. It one hop through the fairway. He goes, "Paulie, I think that ran through." I'm like, "That's fine. We got 345 until there's any trouble." Well, we get down there. The ball had gone 352, completely blocked out. No shot at all. He's angry. And I get why he's angry. He hit it where I told him to hit it. And of course he hit it and we're walking down there. I'm like, "Listen, buddy, you can get rid of your anger. That's just from the last 22 years of my career, understanding that at 54 degrees, no one flies the ball 320 yards and it definitely doesn't go 350 and we laugh." But yeah, the answer to your question, it's Weber's gotten a lot longer, but he's still a solid, I'd say 30 yards longer than him. And he still has that little extra gear. I think one of the things Cam and I are going to work on is, you know, how can we hit kind of that fairway finder? I think that's the next part of Cam's career kind of evolvement is going to be the fairway finder type of shot. He's kind of got one gear with that driver. And so we're going to work on trying to get that maybe second or even third gear coming up.
I was talking with Randy Smith a while back, and he was talking to how he's worked with Scotty since he was a little bit boy. And the truth is Scotty has that fairway finder. I mean, he's got another gear too. He can hit it out there, but if it's not feeling comfortable, he's got that shot. When Cameron gets that, look out.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, that's what we've seen with Tony Finau. You're talking about a guy that struggled to be anywhere. And Boyd Summerhays has said several times, we had to develop a fairway finder. And what happened is it actually just became Tony's go-to shot because he was so long. He doesn't hit the other one. He might hit the other one once a week at the most. And I think with Cam, again, my goal early on that I've seen, we had a chance to win the first two tournaments, finished second and seventh at the Masters, but then struggled the last two tournaments at Hilton Head and Quail only because when he's not perfectly on that, you know, 190 ball speed every single time, it can get away from you very quickly. And so I'm excited to see what we can do going forward, especially like you said, with a distance that I'm still not fully familiar with.
You're getting familiar, but you know what? You can't teach 190 ball speed.
No, you cannot.
You just let that go. You're learning right there.
Absolutely. I have to learn to adjust to him, not the other way around.
Well, I think that I'm going to really, really watch closely, just as you've described your VJ evolution with VJ and then obviously with some other players and then Webb. It'll be fun to watch and see how well
Cam does. Thank you. I'm looking forward to it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about something that most people don't think about, and that is caddies are professionals. Now, when I was growing up and watching Angelo Argia caddying for Nicklaus or Herman caddying for Lee Trevino or whatever, you didn't think of them so much as professionals back then. And obviously the knockabout caddy was bouncing around from town to town, staying with seven or eight guys in the same hotel room, whatever, probably love to drink a lot of alcohol. Caddies are different now. And more often than not, it's becoming a guy like you with a high golf IQ. You mentioned golf IQ earlier. It was one of my questions here. It's like, you know, Ted Scott went to work for Scotty because of his, I mean, Scotty wanted a guy with a high golf IQ. So why is that so important? How big an advantage is it for a player?
Yeah, I think, you know, first of all, the first part of your question is kind of the evolution of the profession. And I think no matter where you are, if you're on Wall Street or if you're coaching one of the best college programs in the country in golf or in football or in anything you are, the more money that's in something, the more expertise is going to be needed, the more IQ is going to be needed, and obviously it's going to push the envelope on the talent level that's going to be in that pool because a lot of people are fighting for a very few amount of jobs. And so there's definitely been a dramatic change from when I started in 2000 to now 2023 because of how much money is in the game. Pretty much for the most part now, I mean, I used to be one of the, you know, best three players as far as caddy goes on the tour. And now there's probably, I don't know, two dozen. I'm a plus five. And I think there's probably another, I would venture to say two dozen guys, probably 20 to 25 guys are a plus four or better that are out there now. Almost all these guys have either played professionally or played high level college golf. What you're seeing now, and again, one of the biggest differences in the old days, we had to do so much more coursework to get ready to go play. Our technology was nowhere near as deep. Our yardage books had nowhere near the amount of information. We used to have to go laser everything from tee to green and then go do the green work, where, you know, now we have these books that we pay $110 a week They have pictures in our book. They have run outs to a bunch of different areas. They've got sprinkler heads to front left, and back left and back right. We've got numbers everywhere. And so what it starts to come down to now, when you take a little bit of the work ethic out, is now it's going to take a different type of work ethic. It's going to take a guy that can understand a golf swing. It's going to take a guy that can really be more of a psychologist on the golf course. It's going to take a guy that understands ball flight laws. It's going to take a guy to understand there's probably five different types of jumpers that can come out of the rough. You know, when we're in Bermuda, it's going to be the high jump goer. It's going to be the high dive bomber. Which one's going to come out? Understand your player. What does he need right now? Obviously, for me, what Webb Simpson needed and what Cameron Young needed are very, very different. And so the ability to kind of be a little bit like a chameleon and move on. But I think there's been so many changes because of the amount of money. You mentioned one of my dear friends, Teddy Scott, and I've always thought Teddy was one of the best in the world because of his personality, high golf IQ, obviously one of those guys that would fall in that plus four or better categories. He still teaches for a living as well when he's home because he loves to help people get better. But he's got that other knack that I sometimes still don't have. And Teddy can make anyone laugh at any time. I think you could run off a four-putt double bogey and going down the next hole, and he could pull something out of the middle of nowhere and just make you laugh, even though there was no desire to do that in the moment. And, you know, it's just guys nowadays realize how much money we can make doing our job, and there's nothing that we're going to do. I learned, you know, Aim Point Express for the main reason of knowing that I saw other caddies doing it that I thought I had a leg on, so to say. And I thought they were outperforming me because of their ability to understand what their feet were reading and the percentages that they were doing. So I dove in full time. I spent 200 hours on it working with a friend of mine here locally that is master certified in it. But these are all things you have to do now in order to continue to get better, to push your player to get better. Number one, for job security, but also number two, obviously the better your player plays, the more money you make. So
the more money you make, and you described it perfectly. You are a professional. You are an amateur sports psychologist. Even you were a swing coach.
Yeah.
I know he would see Butch a couple of times a year, but Webb looked to you for swing instruction. So I'm going to ask a question there because this will help college golf coaches. So if you're a college coach that knows a lot about the golf swing, how much is too much? What should be said? When to say it? It's like the most delicate balance of all time. How often would you talk to Webb about his golf swing during tournament stretches?
What a fantastic question. And I don't think there's a cookie cutter answer. I think it is so personality based to go forward. Go through my college team. We had a guy, Guy Hill, who was an All-American, a great player, and he was a Ledbetter disciple. So him, he would have loved to have talked to you about golf swing for hours and hours. And I think there you could tell him anything at any time, he'd be ready to go. But then you would have had Brian Gay on the same team or Chris Couch or myself. If you would have tried to start talking about wrist angles and the position at the top of the swing, you would have lost us right away. So I think so much of that is based on personality. And my example would be, you know, currently right now I'm working for Cameron Young, who Cameron, if something doesn't feel right and he finds something 5 minutes before he goes to the golf course, you know, if you showed video and he was getting a little across the line, he did this at Hilton Head. He went on the first tee and he was routining here and then a little, you know, kind of rotation of the forearms. And he did it all day purposefully on every shot that he hit on the golf course. And he had just felt it 5 minutes before. Mm. Weber, on the other hand, has zero swing thoughts on the golf course, zero. And so you have to be very, very careful with Weber, kind of what you would bring up. I could talk about rhythm with Webb. Hey, buddy, rhythm's getting really fast. And we know with him, when he does that, it gets rolled in, it gets up, gets cupped. The ball can go both ways. So, hey, buddy, will you do me a favor? Can you walk a little slower with me? Can you work on your breathing here a little bit between now and then? Hey, and your pre-shot, can you just work on a really slow waggle? Those kind of things to get his brain to process what he's going through. And then I had, of course, VJ, who was in the middle, Jerry Kelly, who was very, very feel-oriented, old hockey player. He wanted to get, you know, in that kind of foxhole and go fight. And then O'Hare, who had a lot more Cameron Young in him, who he could kind of work on and think about anything he wanted. So you have a much tougher job because you're not coaching one guy. Obviously, I had the advantage to coach one guy. You've got 10 guys on the team, obviously five guys starting, probably eight who have a chance to start. And so you have to be more personality-based and understand, okay, what do they want? And I think the best way is to ask them, hey, what do you want? Let me paint a situation for you. I see you on the 14th hole. We got a chance to win the tournament. You're spraying it a little bit. I could see you're talking fast. You're walking fast. You're swinging fast. Do you want to know that? And just let them answer and then kind of keep notes on that.
I think that's what I do as a coach. I try to figure out what the kids feel like they need, but I also want them to be ready for that moment when I do talk to them in a round of golf.
Yes.
So we practice it at home. And I think young coaches need to realize that. Don't just throw something on him that you've never worked on.
Yeah.
Try it at home. Figure it out. So I love all of those points of view about how a caddy is a psychologist. He is a swing coach. He's got so many more hats that he wears nowadays. But if he doesn't, he doesn't have a job. So
exactly. And that's why you kind of got to know a little bit about everything.
You do. So in 2003, Hunter Mahan was the number one player in all of college golf at Oklahoma State. I was the assistant coach to Mike Holder at the time. And Hunter was kind of going through that spring playing really well. I mean, the best player in the country, finished 20th or so in the Masters, was having a good run. And we kind of knew he was going to turn pro at the end of the year. And one of the things Hunter asked me was, do you think you might want to, or his dad asked me actually, would you think that you might want to, you know, be a caddy for Hunter when he goes out on tour? And I mean, I spent a whole weekend praying about it, giving it some serious thought. Here I was still an assistant coach, but I didn't know I was going to be the golf coach at Oklahoma State. I had no idea after that. But I will tell you this, I gave it serious thought and I made one phone call to Brad Payne. And wow. I will say Brad, and Brad said, Coach, I don't think it's for you. I think you're where you need to be. And anyway, he talked me out of that. So I've thanked him on numerous occasions, not because he didn't let me become a caddy. It's just that he knew what would be best for my life. I need you to describe the life of a caddy. I know that there are benefits and I know it's great because you're caddying for great players all through your career, pretty much. But there are inherent challenges. What are the biggest challenges for a life in caddy?
Yeah, I'd say for me, definitively time away from home. When it was just me and my wife, when I first started off, you know, it was fine. It was great. She could travel. We would get to go see the world. I'd get done working. Her and I would go to, you know, dinner. We would go see places, go to the Eiffel Tower, go to, you know, back then, see the obviously Twin Towers way back when, and, you know, go down and see the cities every place that we went. But when kids entered the mix, traveling became so much more difficult. My daughter is 17 now. My son's 9. And my daughter's fine now. She's about to graduate. She's going to go on to college. And so she's got her own life. But my son, even now, he wants daddy home. He doesn't really care about the money, the wins, the process, none of those kind of things. He wants daddy home. And I mean, I'm not going to tell you at all that any of that's gotten easier. I'm 51 years old now. I've been caddying 23 years, and that has not gotten easier. If anything, it's gotten harder now. FaceTime makes life a lot more doable. You feel a little bit more connected than you ever could have before. But there are still plenty of days, you know, when you're fighting hard on the golf course, you're struggling on the golf course, you get done, and all you want to do is go play with your son. You want to go jump in the pool, or you want to go run around the block. You want to go throw a baseball. You want to go hit a golf ball with them. Those are the areas for me, I think, that are so tough. My wife's a rock star. She knows exactly what I'm doing. We try to stay connected as much. It's hard on marriage too, though. I mean, because as hard as you try to stay connected over the screen that I'm talking to you right now on, it's just really hard to really stay connected. So we work hard on it. We have a fantastic therapist who is one of our dear friends now. She's a rock star, so she helps us reconnect sometimes. I've got a long stretch coming up right now, 5 out of 6 weeks. I'm going to be gone one stretch, 30 straight days, and it's going to be brutal. Not looking forward to it, but we are going to have the tools in place to really try to succeed. And so I think that's the area. The other part, obviously, is physically. I'm a physical mess right now. I've got 3 herniations in my lower back. I need to have another surgery on my shoulder. I've got a foot issue I need to have done, but you don't have time. You know, I average about 1,400 miles a year of walking, and that would be a typical 25 event year. And so it's a lot on your body. And then traveling from week to week to week to week can be a lot. As a younger boy, it was a lot easier. Now in this body, it's becoming a little bit tougher.
So people also don't recognize how heavy that golf bag is.
Woo, man.
You're not carrying a ping, you know, carry bag. You're carrying a heavy bag with you better have the rain suit in there, by the way.
I have a good story about that. So my back has been really, really bad recently. I thought I was going to have 3 weeks off after the tournament in Tampa, but that's when Webb and I decided to move on. I went to go work for Cameron. Well, I jumped straight out of that, which was 6 out of 7 into 4 out of 5 with Cam. So I ended up doing 10 out of 12. And so my back was just rinsed. I could barely move. I was toughing it out. And I showed up on Saturday at Hilton Head, and Cameron had switched bags. He had called his sponsors. He called Titleist, and he went to a carry bag. And coach, I've never felt anything that relieving in my entire life. Twice during the first round I used it, which was on Saturday, I didn't know the bag was on my shoulder. He said, "Paulie, can I grab an 8-iron?" I said, "Yeah, go." "Oh, sorry." I had to take it off my back because I didn't realize it was back there. But, yeah, a tour bag in sunny days, only about 44 pounds. Obviously, if there's a chance of rain or anything else, that's going to be up to around 50 pounds. And it can get a little bit brutal. I try to stay in the gym as much as possible, but that compression makes sure that these shoulders aren't very built up. So it's a constant battle. I always say that when you're making birdies, it's amazing how much lighter that bag is.
It is. I mean, and college golfers feel the same, that their coach isn't so repulsive if they've just made 3 birdies in a row. I'm not such a bad guy after all.
Everybody wants you to have a good attitude. Birdies helps that attitude unbelievably.
Every time. So essentially the hardest thing for you though, isn't the physical, it's being away from family. And I think that would be the same for every cat. If you've got a family at home, you're traveling. So yes, that's a rough life. So years ago, I had a player who played for me and got his Korn Ferry card. In fact, I was at tour school with him when he got his card. And he didn't come from money. He wasn't a kid that had a lot of money to begin with. And I was talking to him as he was playing that first year on the Korn Ferry. And I recognized, didn't realize it beforehand, but I recognized he was just taking pot luck on a caddy every week and trying to get the cheapest, least expensive caddy, period. And my advice to him was, I don't think you can leave that on the table. You need to find somebody that's going to help you save shots. Why is it so important? Why is it worth the money to get a really good caddy as opposed to taking pot luck like he did?
Yeah, I think the only way you can really succeed, if you are either number one, someone who's just so freakishly talented. You mentioned Hunter Mahan, which the year you're talking about when Hunter finished, I guess, top 25, maybe even 20th at the Masters in Amateur, VJ never stopped to watch anybody hit balls. He stopped and watched that young Hunter Mahan hit balls. And he goes, "Paulie, I don't know who that kid is, but he's going to make a lot of money and win a lot of golf tournaments out here." He just had such a perfect golf swing and the right demeanor. If you're a guy like Hunter, he would have been fine early on, obviously, kind of doing his own thing, bringing buddies out, doing that. The problem is, it's who you're trying to beat. And you're trying to beat guys that not only are as good at you, most likely are even better than you are. And they have already relied on somebody who knows their game, who knows their mind. The next part's just as important. Who knows their heart is a big, big deal. And who knows all of their tendencies. And so, you know, the young man you're talking about, that was me. I had no money. I didn't really grow up money. I got my tour card. I just had to have buddies come work for me because I couldn't afford to pay them. Back then, my ping deal was for $10,000. It's a lot more money now, but couldn't really afford to pay any more money. So I was behind the eight ball. But I'd say the two biggest reasons why you'd want somebody and maybe can afford somebody, number one is you gotta have someone else to walk there with you, because you are nowhere near as calm and as in control as you think you are. The game of golf is not about control. It's about consistency. It's about dealing with consequences of bad shots. We already know, no matter what you do, that something's going to come against you every round of golf. The 59s that have been shot, the 158 that have been shot on the PGA Tour, adversity came at them at some point during that round, and they were able to get over that. And so when you have somebody with you, number one, a bad break, just be able to look at a guy and go, "Man, that's an awful break." "Yeah, buddy, that was an awful break. Come on, man. You know, let's hit the shot." Even something as small as that. But the next part is you're off to a rough start, and a guy can look at you and go, "Hey, bud, you're fast. You're talking fast. You're swinging. Slow down for me. Slow." Or just what I was able to do the last round at the Players for a guy like Webb was I didn't talk about golf at all. I had written down a whole sheet of stuff to talk about that last day because I knew with a 7-shot lead, there was going to be a lot of time where the brain would start running. And so, you know, I took a stance on the NBA Finals I didn't even care about. I just took a stance on it, and we had great conversation. So I would say it's really, really hard when you don't have money and you're trying to figure this out. Find someone that you know. Find someone that doesn't mind putting some work in. Y'all can stay together on the road. That helps with loneliness. It helps with other issues as well. And then the other thing, it's also just nice to have somebody who knows you. And I mentioned knowing your heart. Because sometimes there's things going on that people from the outside don't know. But if you actually know someone, Brad Payne gave you probably the best piece of advice you've had in your professional career. But if you would have asked someone else, if you would have asked me, I'd have said, buddy, go caddy. This kid's going to make a ton of money. He's going to make a lot of Ryder Cups and President's Cups, which he did. But Brad, knowing your heart, gave you a decision that, you know, you couldn't have known. Only someone who knew your heart knew that was what was going to be best for you. And that's what a caddy can do for you.
Wow, great answer. I mean, that's exactly what I wanted to hear right there, and exactly what I want young players to hear. You know, you obviously are a caddy with a reputation. I mean, people know about you. But there's also going to be some caddies that are really good that don't have that reputation yet, sort of like maybe when you were young. So if you're going to give advice to a young professional, Cameron had a little advantage there. He had the Wake Forest connection, Webb Simpson, all. I mean, it was a little bit different. But if you're giving advice to a young professional about how to interview and how to get information, who would be the best caddy for me? What would you say the advice would be for that young pro?
Man, that's really, really good. You know, I would tell him, number one, you need to write down. I would get together probably your closest friend and your family who know you the best and just say, hey, I want you guys to talk about my personality a little bit. What do you think I would need the most? So I would start with the people that know you the best. And just kind of hear them come out. One of them might say, I think you need to find someone who's an encourager, but you might also have somebody who would say, I'll never forget this, but Pat Perez said, Paulie, he goes, I would fire you before the week was out because you're way too positive for me and it would make me angry. So Pat Perez needs somebody who can kind of let him be angry, who can complain a little bit with him, who can kind of ride that storm a little bit. You know, so I think you got to know your personality. And then the first thing you have to look for is someone who matches your personality. Find personality first, and then next find, you know, golf IQ, work ethic. Those would be kind of my little things to go through. I don't think it needs to really be rocket science. Again, especially because how far technology is coming in our game, that a lot of the little idiosyncrasies has gone away. And then if you do find that you need to seek out an experienced caddy and or player, and play practice rounds with them, or jump on Zoom calls with them, ask a ton of questions. I'll probably have a dozen caddies every year that'll call me, that'll have just an hour conversation. Paul, can you help me here? What do you do in these situations? How do you try to do that? And my answer is kind of like you with your team. It depends on their player. I've had, I don't know, probably 20 players call me in the last 5 years and ask me similar questions that you just asked me. Hey, I'm struggling with my guy right now. How do I need to communicate this? As a player, I always say over-communicate is going to win out. And as a caddy, I think really taking your personality traits and putting them down and saying, hey, pro, hey, player, what do you want from me? And then, man, find situations. If you play 1 week and you finish 12th and something happened on the 13th hole, ask them about that. You know, Weber wanted to hear about negatives. Weber wanted you to stand on 14 at Harbor Town and say, hey, buddy, obviously we know we don't want to miss it right. So right now you want to smooth that six iron in there. I don't like that. A little cut six iron has a tendency to miss right. Let's just hit your draw. Let's aim at the right bulkhead and let's trust it and just hit it. Whereas Cameron does not want to hear about the negatives. Most players don't. So with Cameron, you should be like, hey, buddy, I like the firm seven. Let's just hit it left side of the green. So your brain is thinking the same thing. I don't want it to go right. But the way you communicate is different. So again, back to kind of that one thing, you just need to find what personality fits. Start with that and then allow IQ and work ethic to come next.
Great advice. Longtime adage, show up, keep up, shut up. Is that still real in caddying?
No, those days are gone for sure. I'll tell you this though, showing up and keeping up are definitely still the two big ones. But we've seen because of all the verbiage Tiger and Stevie used to have, all the verbiage Bones and Phil used to have, the game has definitely changed in a lot of different ways. There's a lot more communication. Now, I also believe because of the depth of knowledge, again, of the caddies, a lot of great friends go to work for their professionals that have high golf IQs. We saw what happened with Joe Scobber and Ricky Fowler for so long. Just now, Wyndham Clark and his caddy, John Ellis, who played professional golf for a long time. I'm missing a bunch in here. I could go on and on, but so many now. We're seeing it with Xander and his caddy. I can't believe the name's escaping me right now. Anyway, but they're great friends, and he's become one of the best caddies in the game because he knows his player. He's a hard worker with a high golf IQ. If you know those three things, you're going to be successful as a caddy. And then if you are a caddy who hasn't quite found that player yet, because no matter how good of a job I do, it comes down to my player play. One of the best jobs I ever did caddy in my life was Jerry Kelly, 2004, Whistling Straits. I think it was 2004 PGA. He was ninth in the Ryder Cup standings. If you finish ninth or 10th, you qualify. I did an incredible job. My green reads were great. I spent 15 hours on the golf course and we missed the cut by seven. That just shows you that it really doesn't matter. And I remember one of the worst jobs I did was the tour championship when VJ won by three. VJ and I were not getting along at all. We barely spoke, but he won by three that week. So it's not always about that, but I would say stay patient, keep meeting people. The more people you meet, the more opportunities you'll have.
You know, you've literally opened my eyes to more than I thought you would. I mean, this is better than I thought, seriously. But I look back on it and times have really changed. Ben Hogan, when he played at Carnoustie in 1953, had a caddy, and the only interaction they had all week long, Hogan had some candies for energy in his bag and the caddy was eating all of them. And it just really upset Ben Hogan, said, do not eat those candies anymore. But there was no talk about, did he help Ben Hogan? There was none of that. So I think it's amazing that the caddy is so important to he's part of the team and he has to be part of the team nowadays in professional golf. So you've opened my eyes to a few things, which is great. Exactly what I wanted to hear. I want to talk about two more things before we finish. We talked about Brad Payne earlier, obviously one of the pioneers with College Golf Fellowship, a great, great ministry in college golf that I've been a part of forever. You started a caddy retreat through College Golf Fellowship. Tell me about that and how has that been for you?
Wow. Well, thank you for asking. So College Golf Fellowship, for people that don't know about them, please go look them up. It's my favorite organization in the world, and that includes my own foundation. I just love everything that they do. And it's also been one of the biggest changes I've seen. When I first came out in 2000, there weren't very many believers on the PGA Tour. And I actually thought as the tour got younger, which it has, that we wouldn't see as many believers. And the opposite has happened. A lot of young believers, Scottie Scheffler, Sam Burns, Webb Simpson. I could keep going down the list. Scott Stallings and so many more. You got Davis Thompson now who just came out. But all of these young believers who just, they love the Lord. They walk their faith every day, but they can still be successful as well. And all of those guys I just mentioned are where they are and as are, I'd say, deep into their faith, they are because of College Golf Fellowship, what they've done. And so Brad Payne and William Kane came to me, and Willie is the first one that worked for Weber, one of Weber's best friends. He caddied for Webb for a couple of years on tour. And so Willie's always had a kind of a passion and an energy for caddies, and obviously Brad has too. And they just said, hey, Paul, would you be willing to kind of co-sponsor this retreat with us? We think it'd be great to spoil the caddies. Let's get 36 caddies together. Let's spoil them. Let's take them to TPC Sawgrass, TPC Valley. Let's put them up at the Marriott Resort here. Let's feed them to the till and let's spoil them with everything we have for free. And then obviously let's share the gospel with them. And so we did that this past December. And it was incredible. It was a lot of work kind of leading up to it. I had a little bit of stress going into it. I just wanted it all to go perfect. And of course, nothing ever really goes perfect. But I think I got out of it as much as all these caddies that we brought in. We ended up getting 36 guys that came down. We put together a great competition. We had 9 4-man teams. We had some money out there for, you know, where you finished in the team. Willie Kane came and he preached twice. I gave my testimony one night, and Joel Stock and Ben Crane came down on their own time and shared their testimony just about their life and about their walk. And, you know, I think so many times young people, to be honest with you, even older people, maybe don't know a lot about what the Christian faith looks like. They think that it's like being shackled, that you have to follow all these rules. And number one, no, you just have to have faith in one man, and that's Jesus Christ who died on the cross for us. But our testimony is about how big of a mess I am. I was a massive, massive mess before. I'm a little less of a mess now, which we call sanctification, but I'm still a mess. I still make mistakes daily. I still have to ask my wife for forgiveness daily for not being patient enough, or my kids. But what we're trying to do is just share with them the greatest news of all time. And what College Golf Fellowship does, what Brad Payne's meant to my life, I still think the success of my marriage has a lot to do with Brad. Men like Brad and Webb Simpson and William Kane, who I call and talk to when I'm struggling. When I'm struggling as a dad, when I'm struggling as a husband, when I'm just struggling as a man, I call these men and say, hey guys, I'm struggling here. Can you help me? And it's being able to run to place like that. And so a lot of these men that came to the retreat, I've now kind of developed friendships with, and I'll be online with, we'll talk about them, starting to stay with some of them on the road. And so the retreat was great. I'm hopeful we'll get to do it again. It's a little bit of a financial undertaking. It's about 25 grand to put it on. My foundation put in about 5 grand, and CGF took care of the other 20, thank goodness. And they are just a tremendous organization that I can't thank enough for everything they do.
Thanks for that report. I started a couple of years ago a young coaches retreat. So I had 15 guys in my house in Waco, Texas, between ages 24 and 28. Some of them were head coaches, some were assistants. It was an absolute amazing time for me to see young coaches who are walking their faith.
So good.
We're going to do it again this next year. And yes. So when I heard about your caddy retreat, I thought, I'm so glad you're doing that.
Yes.
I hope you get to do it again. So, well, Paul, this has been amazing for me. It's been really, really good. Brad told me he thought you could talk, and by golly, you can, which is great. But I just want to say a big thanks. Mikel, my associate head coach here at Baylor, he started this podcast with me 3 years ago, and we have certain episodes that really stand out. I'm never going to forget this one. In fact, I'm fixing to listen to it after we get the recording.
Coach, thank you so much for having me on. Mikel, thank you as well. And, you know, Coach, I know you're a very humble man, but, you know, I know I don't know you that well, but I know of you very well. And obviously the impact you've had on your players, but other coaches as well. Brad speaks so highly of you. So thank you for having me on. Thank you for letting me geek out about golf for a little while. I think the bad thing is I think you and I could go on for probably way too long for anyone else to listen to. But anytime you'd like to have me on, I enjoyed it, and maybe we could have a chance to do it again.
Well, when you win a major with Cam, I'll have you on the next off week you have. Let's do that.
That's done. It's in. We can write that one in stone. That's all a guarantee.
Thanks again, Paul. Best of luck on this next stretch.
Thanks, Coach.
See you.